Welcome back to episode 9 of the Slide In Podcast. This episode is brought to you by SlideIn.com. We have all sorts of fun stickers that our shop manager from the North Slide, Matt, has designed. That one, I actually think I did this one. It's probably the best. We got Jeremy's Year Mouse, which we might talk about mice a little bit. That's a cool sticker. And then that's the Steely with the Slide In logo in it. I'm still not sure that Kelly knows that's associated with the Grateful Dead. So we're going to keep that a secret from him.
No Rush, no Queen, no Dead. What?
He's got Never rules. Mind. We don't rules. Agree with him.
Yeah, you rules. Noticed.
They're more like guidelines, you know?
Not followed very closely.
That's a Pirates of the Caribbean thing. Okay, so.
I missed that one.
Diving in today. You haven't seen Pirates of the Caribbean?
Yes, I have.
Okay. It's like a top three movie. It's
okay.
Not number two or three. Diving in, I wanted to go to a comment that we had on one of our podcasts from BG Mac. He said, I would love to hear more about how and why you designed those streamer patterns that swim on their side. And when I first started working here, you know, I knew a lot of your bugs, but I didn't know about the flatliner. And it really didn't come onto my radar until we were down in Chile. And watching that fly, particularly the chartreuse over white one, do this in the top of the column. And I think, you know, the second or third biggest fish we saw down there rolled on that thing. And it was enough to, you know, make you feel things. So the question back to BG Mac, why did you design those streamers to swim on their side? And then I think we can kind of dive into some other fly design questions from there.
Well, it's a really long process of how that fly came to be. And the funny thing, I don't know what I did with the...
For those listening, not watching, Kelly's digging through drawers behind the
desk. I think I took it home. The first one that did that was the heifer groomer, a.k.a. Fathead, that floated close to the top with a broad profile. And then Andy Sabota, I was taking flat, I was doing basically flat fish. So I was spinning hair and cutting it flat on each side and then trying to articulate it. And then Andy Sabota did the Swimmy Jimmy, where he took this fly, and it's all marabou. So basically it's a heifer groomer is all it was, and then bent the hook down. And that was to make it go down and do this weird stuff, right? And it did. It was a spectacular fly. There's a long time where Brian Fletching said that was his favorite fly in the world. And he's a warm water guy predominantly, but he fished it for everything. And so one day I was fishing Lando back before. I used to fish Lando, not that long ago either, 20 years. And I fished for a week and never saw a boat. Matter of fact, I saw 5 anglers. Really? And it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And fished it for 3 or 4 years. Fished it on foot first with my buddy John. And just nobody around. Up at the dam, there was a few people. But at any rate, I was in there and I was watching what I thought was a fish that was stunned. And I just assumed something had cracked it, right? It had nothing to do, it was a willow leaf. It wasn't even a willow leaf, it was a longer, it was shaped like a willow leaf, but bigger. And it just got in my head, right? It was like, it just, for the life of me, looked like it was gonna take off swimming. And so always having been part of that injury, you know, something's wrong with the prey, whatever it is, the trigger mechanism. It just made sense to me that the topwater bite, there was no reason you couldn't make, because you know, if you study the water a lot for years, you'll see occasionally fish, and in particular where they plant fish, you'll see these fish just get blown up. And you'll see stunted fish when they, not stunted, stunned fish, like when they plant them and they'd be on the top. And I remember watching that once. Don't even remember what river it was. It was in Michigan. And they're pumping these things out of a truck. And it wasn't even in a river. It was in a pond. And they were, and there was all these fish that were doing this crazy-ass stuff on top. And so, and then come along a little bit, you've got suspension baits starting to show up, and you've got NutriBuoyancy gear baits showing up. And it just seemed to me like there was something left, right? That topwater bite. And so I'd already done my first real articulated fly, which other than the TNA was the first one that we just did marabou. So basically just marabou on marabou, right? It was basically Jack Gartside's minnow, and we put two of them together. And then Russ did the peanut end, or the circus peanut. And then this thing came out, which this fly was a alewife. It was supposed to be a shad type pattern. I'm pretty sure somebody might correct me, but I would put it up that this was the first fly of this style of head, which now is everybody's. I mean, every fly seems to have this style of head now, but it was stacking hair top and bottom and trimming it to make that broad profile with no weight, right? And it was meant to swim just like a minnow. And so, and I would frequently, in particular with this TNA bunker, I would get fish. That fly would be, especially in the really early days, it would barely be underwater, and you'd see him come up and just annihilate that thing. Just blow it up. It wouldn't be that deep. And so between the stupid leaf and the swimmy, and I wanted something that would stay right on the top, as like when you look at these, like if you slam a minnow down or whatever and you throw it out there, you'll see it, it lay on its side. It will not stay like this. It doesn't really, it's not good, right? Or if you see like coming out of a turbine, or if you see a bass blow up a minnow ball, like just crash into them, you'll see those minnows on the surface. And when you go on the white, when you see a shad kill, you see them, they're always like, woo, they're going all over the place. And so it made sense to take a fly, instead of having its orientation to the water like this, to lay it sideways. And to me, that gave me an entirely new system of fishing styles, where this fly rides just like this, right? It's, the hook is down. So with the hook down, the orientation such that the fly rides just like that, which made the bunker style head, the OG style like that, even more adapted to laying flat, right? So then you take your back hook and you put your feathers flat on top of it, and it lays like this. And so now everything in that fly is laying flat on the water. And it did exactly what it was supposed to do. It showed from the bottom. And by the way, that fly, the orientation's one thing of the hook and the profile that it throws, but this fly was designed to fish a specific way. And it was the thought of the retrieve style came before the hook, before the fly. It came before anything. And what I wanted was a suspension bait, or just a floating bait that, I mean, we used to, I love fishing spooks. A Zero Spook is just, it's a topwater. It's how I got started in all this, watching Larry Nixon do that with it, watching him walking the dog. And I love to walk the dog. I just think it's the coolest thing. Like, I go to the ocean. Kip and I still own the lodge in Abaco, I would rather go out on the just out for barracuda and take a plug. I could care less about the rest of it. I could go out and do that the rest of my life. Just walk the dog and watch those things go crazy. And it's truly one of my favorite. I've done a lot of podcasts where people have asked me, it's my last day fishing. And I tell them, well, it might be a 2 mile long lily pad with a frog, you know, where I can walk it back and forth on the surface. So this fly, the intention of that was to keep a wounded bait fish, which if you think about it, it's like its most vulnerable state. It can't even swim. If it's sideways, it can't do anything. It just, If one end is up out of the water, and so if they flop around, all they do is draw more attention. So they're at their most vulnerable state. And so you're bringing this fly back, and how I designed to fish it was I throw it out, and I mean, you've seen, I make a giant rip with this fly. Maybe move the fly, say, I don't care if you moved it 10 feet. All you're doing is drawing attention. And then the fly sits there on the surface.
So for people just listening, that's a giant left-hand strip, like a rope pole.
Yeah,
just pointing at the fly.
Yeah, point it. You finish your fly off, you hit the water, let it sit for a second, and give it this giant pull if you want to give it two. And then you can. I don't care. Yeah, I'm not sure you can fish it wrong, but it's... And so this fly goes, it hits the water, and it makes this big-ass pull, and then it sits, and when it stalls, these tails will start to barely move back and forth because it's slowing down, right? So the head's the slowest. That's going to stop it. You know, it's like hitting the brakes on a truck. You know, your trailer's pulling behind you. The ass end keeps coming at you, and it sits there. And I will do in soft water, which seems like it'd be just the opposite. In super soft water, like the Mo, or anything that's just not really hauling ass, I'll let that sit for 3, 4, 5 seconds and not do a thing. Just let it lay there and then tap, 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 and I'll hit it 3, 4 times, small movements, maybe, you know, 3 to 6 inches, just do this, and then I'll let it sit there again for seemingly forever. Mm-hmm. And you won't believe, they'd come right underneath it and they'll pause on it, just like a bass does. And then when you see the fish coming, like if you can get a visual on it, you tap that 3 times and it's just a blow up. I mean, it is, you don't have to run it. You just have to get its attention. Easily the funnest. I talk a lot about techniques, how if I only could pull the rope, I would quit fishing because it'd be so freaking boring. And the vertical jig that came, you know, that retrieve came for a reason, is that not everything, and, you know, that's how we used to fish a lot of our flies, is that we would let them drop and then pick them up and then let them drop again. So you're jigging them, kind of the same premise, except this one's stunned underwater. The flatliner is a surface fly. And so, and it's just, but it's, I think it's a little too cerebral for a lot of people that want to fish it. They don't want to, I don't think people want to, They want to dumb it down a little bit. They want to pull the rope and keep moving. And when you stall, I remember watching Miles when I threw that out there and let it sit there, and he was like looking at me like, "What the hell are you doing?" But it's in reality, it's more, you're more engaged with your retrieve than you are ever. Even though you're stalled and paused, you're sitting there and you're watching, and then you tap 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 and. You know, and you start doing this soup, now you're talking super erratic because everything's going really, really big movement, then little tiny movements.
You're and in so, 3 planes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it was basically, can I make one do that on the surface? Can I walk the dog? Can I make it go? And after, it wasn't too hard to figure out it would because of the success of Andy's fly, the Swimmy Jimmy. But it was a different look, right? It's like, for those of you who don't know what a glide bait is, it's a hard plug, right? And it kind of goes, and it just kind of sits there, and then you hit it again, and it's always
a zigzag.
Goes, yeah. And it goes this, it's like, oh shit, I'm dying. Oh, got a little bit in me. And it just does this thing, right? And you can watch muskies and pike, whatever, trout. They'll come on, they'll stare at that thing like it's a, just no idea. But they're hypnotized. And the same thing happened. And on super fast water, it's not as, you can't do it as much, right? You have to kind of, but you can still give it the big chug and you can twitch it and you can make it do stuff, but it stays that orientation. It stays very close to the surface. Mm-hmm. And it's just by design, I talk about this with people a lot. I mean, almost daily in the shop. Fly design for me has always been fixing something, right? Not just not just, wow, that swimmy Jimmy or that, you know, whatever, the barely legal. And you'll see a lot of people, they'll get a fly and they'll, maybe by chance, maybe by design, they'll do this fly, but then you seem, it's just like copies of the same thing. And for when I design stuff, it's amazing how often it is something that is absolutely has nothing to do with fishing. And it just makes you think, well, how could we do that, right? It was not just, you know the, even though if you look at it, like I said, the TNA was the first, I mean, this was the first articulated bait fish looking, mimicking fly, I think, in history. I don't know who, there weren't any articulated flies other than trolling flies, and nobody were sculpting heads and building shapes. And from a dry fly perspective, you know, I in my one book I talked about in Cripples and Spinners is that, to me, silhouette is your first thing on your fly. It is the shape that fly sits and where its belly sits and all that segmented stuff. Who gives a shit? They probably can't even see it. Set a profile out there that's perfect. And then it probably wouldn't matter what color that thing was very often, other than when John Stenerson kicked my ass on that freaking pink Albert. But identical flies that were yellow. Purse of shit. But I mean, I've seen it happen, but more times than not, especially in low light, like I do a lot of evening fishing, I find color to be very insignificant. I don't think it's that big of a deal. But then the design aspect transfers to underwater, right? And so now, and you know, when you're talking about a fly that's a size 18 or 22, like we were fishing with John, not much inspection time, right? There's not much to look at. You take a fly like this belly bumper and it's giant, now there's a lot of inspection time. If they don't do a reactionary full-on wide open assault, even then I think there's a lot of inspection. And so by design, what I always did was I would try to, we know a woolly bugger, they'll eat a frickin' woolly bugger. And you'll know if you put two together, they'll eat that too, right? Or three. Somebody wrote in, said, I was doing articulated woolly buggers before you were alive. Well, Mr. Know-It-All, they didn't have woolly buggers before I was alive. And there were a hell of a lot of flies that weren't out before 1959. And so it's just funny how everybody wants to, but, you know, my design it isn't like that one sells well. Let's make one that looks like it.
Right.
Right. To me, it's just like
it's purpose driven,
completely,
solving a problem.
and then looking at it, you know, just going out. When we were talking the other day with Johnny about design and all of this, and how many flies I have, and then how many failures compared to the successes, right? I mean, easily, minimum 10 to 1, if not 20 or more to one.
Right.
The time that I used to sit and just mess with materials all day, but it was never just like just messing with a woolly bugger, right? It was like, okay, well, that one's been done. How could you make this better? Well, how can you make? And so this glide bait thing comes along with that. And one of the things about, you know, with a subsurface fly, it's very hard to glide bait because the materials are so soft. So right. You can fold it one direction because the current will push it. We're going perpendicular to the flow. Mm-hmm. So you can fold it with the current, but it's hard to make it do the other one. That's when you pull and you start doing that.
Right.
But when it's on the surface, it's really easy to, because the current catches it and you pull it back and it's on top and it's never under sinking, although it works great underwater. Maybe better. I don't know. Pretty damn good. But so everything's always been like, how do we do something? How do we make, you know, insanity happen down there?
Yeah.
And so I don't know, because I get asked this all the time, how'd you do these? And it was, and they almost all, you look at my first crayfish pattern, It was two claws and rabbit strip wrapped around the front. That's it. And somebody knocked it off. I forget who it was. So it had just a pair of it had a deer hair nose to spread the things, and two pinch, and then just wrapped a bunny. I'll tell you, I'm hard pressed to find one that fished outfished that. Yeah. It just looked like hell and wouldn't sell. It would not make. So you get a little of that when you start designing them. You know how well it's working. Well, how can I sexy it up, right? Yeah. So I took the exact same fly, the very first one. We've got some over there. And so all we did, put pinchers on it, because you can't get away from what's making the fly work. You can't do it just, you know, the pinchers are what, that's what draws their attention. And then we just laid a carpus over the back of it and ribbed it so it looked really real. I don't think it fished any better, but it sure sold like crazy, right?
Yeah.
And then it became an obsession, like crayfish became an obsession, because I talked about that in one of our videos about sitting underwater poking crayfish. And I got to think about it after we did that, and I said I did 7 hours. I did 7 hours on trout water. I did hundreds in Great Lakes, watching crayfish, always poking them. I love to poke, just see what they would do, right? But, and then I became obsessed with, how do we get one that actually looks like they do underwater? Mm-hmm. Because all the flies that I'd seen till then were pretty much, if they weren't a knockoff of what the original thing we did was, it was really exacting everything. You know, the pinchers are back, they're glued together, they're this, and you put them in the water and they spin in circles. That's where failure comes. It's like you can tell when people didn't fish their fly. Mm-hmm. It might be the best looking fly on earth, might be the most realistic thing you put underwater, and the thing's upside down, sideways, spinning in a circle, looking like shit. But I remember one pattern in particular that had fixed claws that I don't know how many hundreds of those thousands I sold. Absolute worthless fly. It's tied by a really great fly tire. It had no place in fishing.
Yeah.
Not in moving water. I never fished it in a lake. But in moving water, just tumbled like a circle.
What's the old saying? Flies are tied to sell the fisherman, not the fish, something like that.
And we don't do that.
No.
My flies have to sit, used to in the old days, I wouldn't release a fly for 2 years. Because you never know. You go out in one day. I'll tell you a perfect example of that. What's that one? It was one of the top selling flies in Montana fly history. What's that crystal flashy one? Jesus.
Which one?
Oh, it's just Sparkle Minnow.
Oh, yeah.
Sparkle Minnow. I fished that thing for 2 years and did Johnny on this river, and we thought it was the worst fly on this river. I couldn't catch a damn fish on it. Johnny couldn't. Guides would come in and just grab him by the fistful. I'd say to him, you caught fish on that piece of shit? I'll kill it with this thing. And I was up filming a TV show, or maybe it was a video. No, it was a TV show. It was a... I think it was Bill Erdman and I, Gear versus Fly. I'm getting my ass at Lando. How do you get your ass kicked at Lando? You've got to be like...
I have gotten my ass kicked at Lando.
Oh, my God.
Once.
That's hard.
Once.
And so I've been through everything. And Bill's, you know, we're not killing it. Even in the gear, we're not killing it. But I put that Sparkle Minnow on and just lit the world up. And every since then, I put it on here and I catch fish.
Yep.
But for two freaking years, I couldn't catch fish on it. And the same thing with... most fly designers, I'm privy to a lot of this because a lot of flies come in looking like mine. And then the company will call and say, this fly is pretty damn close to yours. I say, yeah, pretty much identical. But, you know, and I see the submission letter and they always say, this fly catches more fish than any fly in the world. It's always, you know, the guy who designed it or gal, it's like the greatest thing in the world. Kind of like I said about my own. This, like I would tell Johnny, this is going to be the greatest fly in history. They're going to make a statue of me. And the next day he goes, how is the greatest fly in the world? Not so greatest. Didn't even get a look on it. But you can see flies that have the right So the parts are to put together, and you can see that it should work. Mm-hmm. And so I would tie them, give them to Johnny predominantly, or Skinny, because Skinny could find fault in anything I did. But that meant if one worked, he loved it. It was great. And so we would, you know, just fish them for at least a year, usually two, and then we would release the fly to public. But we wouldn't just, you know, greatest fly ever. You got to try this thing. It's never caught a fish that we know of, but I'm sure it will. None of that.
No, I mean, that's bullshit. That's what it is.
Oh, I've seen lots.
It's used car salesmen.
I had a guy send me a fly once, and I asked him how it fished, and he was a great designer. And he said, I'm sure it fishes great. That means it's never touched the water.
Yeah.
I said, oh, so I'm your guinea pig. I get it.
It's like when Johnny brings new flies into the shop, he always gets samples first.
And fishes
them. And
then
fishes them. Yeah. And like, I can't remember what pattern it was, but it was one we were thinking about bringing in. And, you know, all the shop guys are looking at it going, oh, man, that thing looks really fishy.
Johnny goes, is it that little minnow? I said the same thing.
My thing goes, yeah, and it isn't. They don't eat it. You know? And maybe some rivers they do. But
I remember that little bait fish thing, and I sold that might be the greatest fly in history.
Yeah.
I fished the hell out of it. I did a bunch of trailer fly with that and didn't. I look at that thing in the water. There is no reason. And I'm sure whoever designed that fly did it somewhere where he fishes or she fishes and kicked the living shit out of, maybe it's a stalker. I don't know what makes, or maybe it's just us. I don't know. But I know I fished that sparkle for 2 years and didn't, and now it's in the rotation.
Oh, that sparkle minnow's like, if I can't buy one, sparkle minnow's the place I'm going to find one. You know, it's a swing fly. It's a downstream fly. Like
that's why you can't just go out and say they're going to work or not work.
Right.
You got to test them.
Right. Yeah. One day of success doesn't mean anything. I mean,
don't play with Marabou while you're talking.
Yeah.
It's very good.
I think kind of a sidebar to this that I've been meaning to ask you for a while. When
the goat was stuck.
Okay, good. So for somebody that like walks into a fly shop who may not know a lot of individual patterns, I mean, we get caught up in this ultra fishy world of being in this valley and especially in this fly shop surrounded by really fishy people where, you know, if somebody asks you what you were fishing, you can't say, oh, it was kind of an olive-y deer hair, like, you know the name, right? Everybody knows the names of it.
If they work here, they better.
Yeah, they better. So for those who may not know the names of flies, maybe a couple steps removed from that, you know, all of these flies that you tie are purpose-driven, right? Mm-hmm. They're meant to be fished a certain way. Some of them you can make mistakes with how you're fishing them, and they're still going to work. If you go pick a fly out of a bin, what are a couple of things, questions you can ask yourself that will lead you to how the fly was meant to be fished?
Well, the first thing I look at is what's the profile going to be, not what I see. Like, I sit here and play with, I love these steelhead flies, right? And I'll sit here and mess with this stupid little wing and play with it and comb out all the little hackle and shit. It's going underwater.
It's going to look different.
It's going to go whoo, tubular.
Right.
Right? And so I look at any fly, like this is maybe my new favorite fly, right? The Slick Willy.
It's my favorite.
This thing it's fishy, right? But all streamers that are minnows start with a bucktail, right? This was one of my early flies. This actually was a steelhead fly because I caught my first steelhead on, I just tied it for a brown trout, but I caught my first fish was a steelhead on it. And the first thing you have to realize is that you're pulling the fly and there's tension against the fly and there's current against the fly. So when you see a fly and it's all puffy like this, you're going to realize it's real simple that in your mind you could just pull that back and, okay, suddenly I got a smelt size. It's a spectacular juvenile whitefish, right? Basic 2-3 tones, you know, All your prey has got a white belly, and it's usually got some sort of lateral flexion of color, and then it'll have the top of the back. And so, but then you go into stuff like this marabou, and there's all this crap all over the place, and things are flopping around. You have to see in your mind, what's the silhouette of that fly going to be? And you have to know, are you a fast rope puller, where you're one of these people that you rip really fast, and you know that your fly is going to compress and expand, compress and expand, oh, bump, 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 just like that. If you're a slow retriever, you're not going to get any of that expansion. You kind of look at the fly, a woolly bugger is a perfect example. What is it? It looks like nothing. It isn't anything. It's, what is it, right? It doesn't change a lot, but its tail moves. So I look at things on them like, where's the movement going to come from this fly first, right? Is it all tail? Is it going to have, is it, you know, most flies nowadays are articulated. So there's, you know, flatliner. So this is that was the saltwater version, actually, of the bang tail. This fly, I can see that it's going to have a very hard time getting skinnier than that, because the head's shaped where the head is. The marabou is going to stay out even on a pull, because the head's going to stop the transfer of the water over top of the marabou. It's very seldom going to get smaller than what it is right there. Right? I can see that in my mind. I understand that. And a slick willy, because the way it's set, it's going to be basically out like that. Another thing I look for, and this is a great example of that, I got totally lucky on the learning process of this. What did we do with that thing? I think we took it over someplace. There it is. This was my first, right when synthetics started. And we started using this stuff. And I did this bullet head, and we took it down to the South Fork of the snake. And it's just, you know, I'm thinking, my, that's really light stuff. I put so much material on it. I literally, two-thirds of this fly is missing right now. And I put it on, and it's not much of a day. And I put this fly, Johnny put it on, and that day started. And I mean, we put an absolute annihilation on that river. Not we, Johnny. I was rowing as usual. And so, but every time the fly would come in, it went, and for those of you who have not heard me say this before, I always carry a comb with me. And with fish synthetics, including the slick willy, which doesn't have much stuff in it, always keep a comb, and you can comb it out, right? And because it'll get all the teeth in this.
Yeah, it gets all matted.
It just gets matted. And you know, you'll go like this about four or five times, and you'll have a whole bunch of material in your hand in this comb. Well, this fly, the more I combed it, the bigger the fly got. And so with synthetics, and particularly super fine angel hairs and stuff like that, they get matted on themselves. The water is on top of them, not between the fibers. And so the lighter you make this, suddenly the water's getting between these fibers, and this fly just starts growing. And every time he'd catch a fish, and I'd comb that fly out, and I'm like, oh, there's not anything left of this thing. The reason we still have it, I finally said, duh, I got to keep this fly. I'm not going to remember how I tied that piece of shit. I mean, it's not a very clean fly. This was the absolute OG double bullet, and unbelievable what happened with it, right? But so that's just a sidebar, is that when you look at a super overdressed fly, ask yourself, can the water get between it? Can the water get between the filaments, and will it expand, or will it change and start becoming wrapped, you know, getting encompassed by the water and not allowing it to swim? So when I look at flies, I look at a semi-lightly dressed fly that's going to throw a big profile, if that's what I want. If I want a leech, I don't necessarily want a big profile. So I look for, if it's designed like it should be a leech, I want it to do what a leech does. It's very tubular. It's got a lot of undulation in it. You know, leeches swim like this, and I don't want a lot of stuff. Like people always say, woolly bugger's a great leech. I think it's a shit leech. I don't think it's a leech.
Yeah.
I swear, I think it's a crayfish pattern. I just think it's general enough, like, what the hell is it? Fish are very inquisitive. and no one can deny that there's probably been as many fish caught on a woolly bugger as anything on earth.
Combined.
I mean, yeah, oh my God. Yeah. I mean, so I look at stuff like that, but I try to see, we're kind of past the days of, well, that Royal Coachman sure is pretty. Yeah, well, what the hell is it? I mean, what does a Royal Coachman look like under a streamer, right?
Yeah.
Nothing. I mean, yeah. But pretty, so they must like that. But we're kind of into the world of things are starting to put the puzzles coming together, right? And so you're seeing them. I even though, like, you look at this fly, there's a lot of marabou in it, it's not really that much. It's just they're stacks. And that was the original, you know, the original TNA bunker. Sorry, Blaine, but the original TNA bunker had hackle wrapped around it, and they were shorter in the back and bigger in the front. And it was just, but it was a profile like this, right? Yeah. And so we wrapped it, and then I started looking at the flies when these were coming out, and I found it, instead of wrapping marabou around it, I got a better profile by going
stacking vertically.
But originally they were all, the TNA bunkers were all
Palmer.
There's
marabou.
I did an article in the early 90s about TNA bunkers, about it, about how we did it, and then stacking that head. But back to the design thing, I would encourage you to know what you want out of the fly. And that has to, man, that's as much as how you fish it, it has to do with, like, if you like to jig, or if you're a pull, or if you're a jerk stripper, you know, all these flies, particular if you like to animate your fly with a lot of kick, mm-hmm. you want, I would encourage you to find things that have deceiver tails. You know, a tail back here that's really long, Johnny's Kill Whitey. Johnny's traditional kill, the regular Kill Whitey with the tail that's that long, oh my God. I mean, that thing just kicks. Not a good slow retrieve fly. It's made to do things, right? And so the design of flies for me has to do with what I can make the fly do. I think this is the best example of every fly I've ever done. Because most of the other ones are minnow imitations that move and have a lot of things that move for them. But the Nancy P, this fly, when I was talking about how crayfish, I don't know, was it two or three podcasts ago we did, and was talking about how what you saw underwater when you saw a crayfish. And when you look at this fly, and you look back here and you see that the legs are sticking out, but you can see how its legs aren't together. There's a gap here. And when you see a crayfish swim, if you want to take the time to go out and just put on a mask and snorkel and poke one, just get them go. When you can get them to swim, what you'll see is they swim backwards. So this is their tail, even though the eyes are in its ass, a lot like Johnny. This thing's back here. This is the swim. This is the pinchers. His head would be right here, right? And this is the tail, which scoops. Its tail goes under like that, right? And so, and none of this stuff really means much to me. What you see when that thing swims is you'll see their pinchers go like this, and there's an air gap between their pinchers, just like that. There's an air gap, and they do light, dark, light, dark, light, dark. Every time they scoop, they go sideways like that. I mean, their pinchers do this.
Yeah.
But there's always an air gap between his head and the pinchers back here. There's tiny little ass things like that. Goes back to a pincher that's that big and that wide.
Right.
Well, that's that big paddle down here, it looks like. And here's that air gap where their head's back. Probably they can, I don't know what the hell they're looking at because they're going freaking backwards. And so, but by design, when I kept looking at those, this one, no matter how I pulled it, I mean, I could probably enhance this a little by simply making it turn sideways back and forth. And I've done a lot of interviews and stuff where the JJ is a two-tone woolly bugger with rubber legs, is, of all the time, I told you when we were sitting, when Jerry was throwing flies at me, and yeah. I had all these great flies. I was just talking about the one fly that was too stiff, and there was a bunch of them that looked like that. And all these flies are coming at me, and he's swinging, right? He's just tight line going like this, swinging them. Or he'd come up and just let it go by, almost dead drift. And I'm looking at these flies, and I'm like, they all look like shit, and they don't look anything like. Then he put on a woolly bugger. And here comes this fly. And even when it was monotone, it was all olive or all black. I don't remember. No, it was black with the, it was the original Umpqua, who I still think does the single best if they do that style. It was, thanking you.
Yep.
The original, nobody ever did one better than that one, in my opinion. It was just black, but it had two stripes of flashaboo down the side. And that tail came at us, and it gave this illusion, even though it was reflective. It was the tail, the swim portion of the crayfish, of the woolly bugger, it was showing me the air gap because that flash was in there. And then I had him throw a JJ, which was yellow with brown.
Yeah.
And it had the legs back. Nothing's ever, it looked exactly like the crayfish. So that's what this came down to. It came, actually the very first one did not have a hair head. The very first one, I went right up to a cone.
Chenille?
Oh, chenille right up to the cone.
Okay.
And then it looked good. And it fished, I did that for whatever reason. It looked good. It fished really, really well. And so it stuck. But in reality, that should be going down so it does more of this. Or maybe even sideways, and so it made the tails go away.
Okay, so trying to identify kind of what it's imitating is a great way to figure out how it can be fished, right? Bait fish, mm-hmm. crawfish, sculpin, leech, whatever you're trying to imitate. What are some other kind of clues in the way that a fly is built in terms of how it's supposed to be fished? One of the things I'm thinking of is weighting in the fly. So, you know, slick willies unweighted versus a dungeon has a hair head and dumbbell eyes, so it's theoretically neutrally buoyant.
Almost all my flies are unweighted in some respects. Because, like, when you weight them, a lot of my dungeons don't have eyes. When I tie
when
my
you
own.
Tie them from your
yeah, yourself. When I tie them for myself, they don't have eyes. But waiting, were you done with your question?
Well, I guess the thing I was kind of looking for in there was, a circus peanut, variations of that. There's flies out there, peanut envies, that are better for jigging, mm-hmm. right? And you get a more vertical action because they don't have a buoyant material, mm-hmm. and yet they have a large weight, you know, whether it's lead eyes, cone head, whatever it is. So that could be one hint, or if it's completely unweighted, you know, sold in a shop, unweighted, swimmy jimmy, slick willy, these kind of things, like meant to be fished on full sinking lines, and generally you're going to have a much more active, fast retrieve.
Yeah, most of them. Other than the envies and stuff like that, and the Nancy's that you jig, and I mean, when I weighted the dungeon, that's the original dungeon right there. When I weighted the original dungeon, it was because the head was too buoyant, because it was much broader than they are now. And it basically, I'm looking at how much hair I'm putting on that thing. I was trying to do a bullhead, basically. It was,
yeah.
And it was like that. And then I knew it had to have something to counterbalance that head, right? And so, but you also have to realize you're fishing a sinking line. So you're trying to pull flies underwater, and sometimes that you have to understand what the material does. If it's got like a zoo cougar, the zoo cougar will float. You could fish that all the way down the river, never get it underwater if you weren't in a sinking line.
Right.
And then and everybody says, why don't you ever put a cone head on? I said, I did put a cone head on. I hear that's one of my biggest questions. Have you ever thought about doing, probably,
yeah.
you know, and because it's something as complicated as putting lead eyes on a fly, right? Have you ever thought about that? Just some things are by design. And
right.
the zoo cougar was designed to hover and do this. And it's not supposed to go up and down. It's supposed to just and come back up. It's just, that's what it was made to do. And so you have to look at that when you're looking at buying flies. You should be able to, if you're buying these, you should have a kind of firm grasp that if it's got a cone head in the front and yet it's got a giant hair head like a woolly sculpin, it probably is neutral buoyancy. It's probably just enough to get the head down, so when you pull it, it'll go a little bit, but it'll continuously kind of flatten out, right? And so when I look at them, I just look to see if I think the materials will stay where they belong. Are the materials truly going to stay here, or are they going to get hung up underneath things? You look at some tails and you say, well, God, that thing's going to get hung up itself constantly. Sometimes I was wrong on Johnny's. I didn't think his tail would get hung up. I just thought it was too much. I was wrong. It was great. As a matter of fact, they could be longer now. But just when you look at them, like, you should have general classifications. I mean, you should have bait fish, wounded bait fish, crayfish, and leech of some sort, right? And you kind of got that general class. So it's like, okay, yeah, that's going to fill that really nicely. And then you look at how you fish, right? How do you, are you just a burner? I probably jig as much as I'm doing this on film a lot. I do that where I'm moving because a lot of times we're trying to get that explosive bite, right? But when things are tough, or if it's just not, I mean, I'm straight into that lazy ass thing, right? I need a fly that'll do this. If I'm going to jig it, and that can be a weighted fly, and it can be a lot of things. As long as it does this, if the head's just slightly, it doesn't have to be super heavy, like a Nancy's got a pretty good, but it's got a giant hair head on it, yep. Right? It barely does this. Because crayfish don't do this,
right?
Right. When you study them, you'll see that they are so almost perfectly flat always. But yet, any gear, you know, we're jigging, you're up and down, you're pulling things straight up and down, they eat the hell out of them, right? They've got their attention. So I don't know. It's a broad thing about design. For me, it's as basic as just looking at this slick willy. I know it's going to carry its profile all the way through its body. It's got very little material in it, so the water gets between it. And it does what it's on a bait fish, on a running bait fish, mm-hmm. Right? And then I go into the sculpin world. I got to tell you, I don't, the dungeons of sculpin, it's a good fly. I still think the conehead woolly or the normal woolly sculpin, just the hair head, woolly bugger with that head on it, I still think that's about as good a, if you want to improve it, put a plume of marabou on the top. I think that helps it a little bit, gives it a little bit more profile. But sometimes simplicity's it, like a woolly bugger and like a woolly sculpin. Woolly sculpin's just a hair-headed woolly bugger. It's not like it was, it's nothing new.
I mean, but, especially if you're tying working flies.
Yeah.
If you're a guide tying flies for clients, like, they don't.
Well, there's the other side to that is that Russ Madden has one of the greatest lines ever. The only difference between you and everybody else here is your fly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if every single fly goes down that river is a, you know, woolly sculpin, and you do something different, and you keep the profile, and you keep what makes them eat the fly, and you, well, you know, flash is a good example. I mean, when they put flash in the tails of them, that it was a better fly. But it's, if as a guide, that's changed a lot. In the old days, you know, your fly shop, you were known when you opened a fly shop in the 60s, 70s, 80s, not so much in the 80s, but 60s, 70s, early 80s, generally it was, the only difference between you and the other two maybe in a state was that you are known for your flies, right? You went to the Troutsman because of the Troutsman Hex and the Zoo Cougar or whatever, and that was your fly that you probably tied back in those days.
Yeah.
And then I think it was in 84, we got royalty tying, and then all of a sudden all hell breaks loose. And so we're all submitting flies because we're getting paid for them, right? And so then it wasn't, there was, it just grew so fast when the Black brothers started, you know, they had, there was Umpqua and McKenzie and I forget the other one. But anyway, it was kind of the first, they were just great ties and they're everywhere. And then the shops weren't necessarily just known for their flies. They had a lot of flies, right? And the streamer thing wasn't around yet then, really. And so I don't know where I was going with that, but it was a different world back then. Now, part of what I, well, that's what I was getting at, was the whole fly, the singular fly. Like, you would have guides that would never show anybody their flies.
Right.
That was their ace in the hole. They still had him with that, may still be. I mean, I've been out of it so long. But I had the Zoo Cougar, I did not show one of my guides for 2 years. I kept that thing right to me. Yep. It was, I guided 200 days a year back then. I mean, it's like, this is my fly. I might have showed Russ. But I mean, but he probably made it better. So it was a different world then. And now there are so many designers that are so freaking good. I mean, it's not like the old days. I mean, now they're the people like the Charlie Cravens, you know, and Shoeys and all these, I'm just, there's a billion of these guys out there, just great tires, right? But they're also fishy.
Yeah.
And they, so now.
Well, shit, there's eight of them at this shop under the age of 25.
It's crazy. I mean, all design great flies.
Nate's almost 28, but yeah.
Yeah, how old's Hunter?
Yeah, Hunter's
12?
No, yeah, 22 now, I think. Kyler's 18. He's,
yeah. Oh, God, I forgot about him. That kid's, but I mean, and now, like, with the YouTube channels, and, you know, as much as a few of us fished in the old days, most people didn't fish that much in the old days. And I'm talking the 80s, you know, ancient times. In the 80s, people were still just getting into recreational fishing. They may go on vacations places, but, like, they didn't fish that much where I was from. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody did because the rivers weren't very busy. Right? Anywhere, period, end of discussion. And now there's a lot of anglers. It is, there's a lot of just biomass out there of humanity. They're out there, and they're fishing a lot, like you guys. I mean, the thought of doing 150, 200 days in the old, that didn't happen. One, you had seasons. There's a lot of shit. Right. You had seasons, rivers open, closed. You might go steelheading. Most people hunt and fished. And they skied, and they
didn't. Well, you got to milk your cow in the morning. And
yeah, well, you know, I had to go cut wood to make the fire. It's a lot of shit was different, and that's only in the 80s.
Right.
Just, I mean, the 70s, it was less. But then as the 80s came on, you still didn't have people. Hell, I saw a thing where, I don't know how much it was, fly tackle deal, one of those. The average angler still fishes 15 days a year or less.
Yeah.
A year. So now you got guys like you guys who do it for a living, and their tires, they watch YouTube. Shit, I did, the other day, might have had a small hangover, something to do with New Year's Eve, and I watched 5 hours of video of fly tying.
Yeah.
Between consciousness. No, I'm just kidding. I was just sitting there, I just didn't feel like working all day, and so I can go down a Davy McPhil rat hole so easy. I can, oh shit, that can be hours. And so I just kind of, the whole time you're learning, right? The whole time, even a dinosaur like me. Now you take you guys, you walk in here, and then a big difference is just the simple fact how much the younger crew fishes, right? And what I notice, I don't know if they're all like that. I assume most shops are like us. They come back and like, we crushed it on this one, right? Now, in the old days, a lot of secrets.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I don't know why, because shit, there was no, I go out and fish. Hell, I could go any river in Michigan that I wanted, really, including the Pere Marquette until like 83, 84. I don't know when that one blew up. But I remember when it was basically Walt Grau, John Clusen, and I on that river. It was pretty rare for us to see somebody else. And they're probably saying, I don't remember seeing him there until then. I mean, I started fishing that in 76, guiding it in 77 or 8. And not much, once or twice, you know, but you were there. And, but I mean, never seen anybody. But right. We kept our shit so secret that nobody, yeah. We wouldn't, Walt and I changed flies. Walt, I think, is Walt Grau. I've talked about him a lot. I think he's one of the single greatest designers of flies in history. Russ Madden, if y'all don't know who Russ is, you need to take some time and go look at. He's got this crazy ability to design flies that they're not intricate. They're just, they make fish eat. And Walt was the same way. But I remember when we swapped flies, and it was like nobody ever did that. You just kept your secrets to yourself. And there was, on an entire river system, there might be two of you.
Right.
Or three. Like, you know, now there's 150.
When, so you know who's really good about that, the sharing secrets, is Chuck. You know, Chuck's a really good tire. Mm-hmm. Since he got into the spay thing, he's been doing a lot of spay bugs now. And just, you know, because he's done streamers forever. He's colorblind, so the colors are always a little funky. But
sometimes I wonder about Russ with that. Because Russ's colors sometimes were like...
They look funny.
To me, they did.
Yeah.
But this year, this year as hell, they fish think great, they yeah. looked funny.
Well, so Chuck's really good about, like, he'll tie a batch of flies and then just come in and say, pick one. And, you know, he'll try to do as many, you know, with slight variations, and then say, go fish it. Let me know how it goes. It's just crowdsourcing information on his flies. But I like that, you know, he's not keeping secrets. In fact, he's trying to make his stuff better by having more people fish it. I mean, sure. He's always, hey, you guys going up there? You want to fish any of this stuff? Like,
I did that with Johnny.
Yeah.
Because Johnny fished more, you know, and right. just. Half the time he came back and said he didn't fish it. It's my only one. What'd you do with it? I don't know. I lost it. Piece of shit.
I don't know why you reminded me of this, probably the secrets thing, but there are places I will fish where, what I would describe as secret places that I don't want to tell people about.
I didn't say places. I said...
Yes.
Flies.
No, I know. But there's, so what I'm saying is there are places.
It's the same thing back then.
Yes. So there's places I fish where, you know, I go throw streamers. And when I'm done, I cut the streamer off and I reel my line up, put my reel in my bag, and come back with my rod broken down. Just in case I see someone.
Done it 100 times in my boat when I was guiding, see an angler downstream, off come my fly.
Yep.
The Zoo Cougar in particular. Chop that thing right up. Put on a 9.3 or a mother minnow. I don't give a shit what it was, but it sure didn't have that fly on. It was just, but that was a guide thing, right? And heavy, there was no pressure. There was nothing. We thought we had pressure. but that was kind of a guide thing. But then, you know, I was always caught in a catch 22. I'm a shop owner, guide, and so... The Zoo Cougar at first was that was the one that, is it really going to stay this good, or is this just a fluke? Should we just keep it and, you know, just hold it out for hard times, you know?
It stayed that good.
Ration it out for certain. And then I've told that story probably twice on this podcast. The first time, I'm pretty sure it was Russ and I. We used to fish together a lot. And I think it was him and Jimmy. And we got to, I don't know, on the upper Manistee, and I saw a Zoo Cougar in a tree. And I remember my heart sinking, going, shit, it's over. Because that thing was like throwing a cheeseburger out there, man. They just couldn't say no to it. They would just climb on that fly.
I mean, they still can't.
Yeah, it's still a great fly.
Fishing the hunt for a 30, I mean, you flipped it out to the left side of the boat, and a 25-inch buck ate it off
top.
Yeah, that
thing off the surface. I tell you, that second time that happened. I used to have a picture of that in here. The giant one?
Yeah.
Remember that Zoo Cougar that's in that giant brown trout? That's one that ate the son of a bitch on the surface.
That might have
been. It was hanging up in here somewhere. Huh. I think I threw it away because they were getting kind of messed up from falling off the wall. But I'm pretty sure that was the one that ate it on the floating down the, not only did it not get the hook set, I didn't even, was he was talking, was yeah. back to it.
Are you going to move that thing?
Oh, God.
So that's another fly. That fly, the Slick Willy, and the white flathead kitty, maybe the yellow one too, just because those are the colors I fish in that bug mostly. But I fish those like the flatliner. When I saw you do that down mm-hmm. in Chile, I'd never seen that before, that technique, the giant strip tap tap. Mm-hmm. And then what I do is I do another strip to then catch up to it to get my slack out. Yeah. And that one's, you know, there's no set amount on which I strip there. It's just to get tight to it. And then another giant strip, tap, tap. I do that with all those bugs, Slick Willy, Zoo Cougar, white, or the flathead, any color really.
I think that's important because I think it's more than just that technique. I think that screams the validity of the whole aggressive. When the fly hits and you pull it hard, right? Why I preach the jerk strip and not the that big pull. It doesn't matter what fly it is either. I don't care if it's a Zoo Cougar and you make bubbles on the surface. That hit and run is the impetus for a large fish to be triggered. That is what tells that fish solely by wavelength. It's just transmitting so fast to that fish. And that fish becomes completely on alert, and he has got an opportunity now to inspect it, and he's going to very quickly.
Very quickly.
It doesn't usually take that third pull on that thing, you know, first or second, and that's the difference, is that that's the triggering. When we were talking about last week when we did Joe's, we were talking about that podcast about swinging flies and the difference between cross stream and what we should have, I don't even know if we said it, but it's that first impetus where you get that fish's attention, whereas if you just put the fly out there, and it's, I say it in every seminar I've ever done, the fly hits the water, the fish is on your fly. I don't care. It's why when we deliver the fly, we want it to hit hard. Boom! If that fish is 10 feet from that fly, it knows exactly where it is. It probably is within 3 feet of you in less than a second.
Yeah.
It's already there looking, because that's what a predator does. It identifies and goes, right? And you know, but a lot of, if you watch predatory action with a fox, with a house cat, with anything, a mountain lion, whoo, they're on it. They get that, whoa, I know you're here. And they're so close to getting you right now. But then they got to see that second movement, right?
Right.
There's something change. Something goes. I mean, the great ones, that fly hits and blows up, and you swear to God that thing did not hit the water.
No, they knew it was coming.
It's like it's whoosh, gone, right? It's that fast. And so that retrieve just screams why it's important. And I've told that thousands of times all over the world. If you do nothing else, the second your fly hits, do not lose sight of the fact that that is the most important part of this whole equation.
Yeah.
If the fly hits the water, do anything but stand there with picking your ass. Do not let that fly float. If that fly floats, I think you probably have done about 90% of harm. That fish isn't going to make it.
Right.
The fly doesn't. You think about this flatliner. It's all freaking marabou and tail, right? If this thing hits and just absolutely sits there as a gob, it isn't going to look like much. That's going to just float out here. Suddenly it's like this thing's disintegrating in front of the fish. So it hits and it runs 3 feet. Well, now there's a whole lot of adrenaline pushing that fish, if they have such a thing, I don't know. Here I come. And then you get to, then it can die. But it's already triggered something inside it.
So I think that this kind of ties back into what we talked about last week with, well, and this earlier in the show, fly design. Your flies are designed to be moved. They're
most
not designed to be swung. Now they can work for that, right? Now, it still happens, but that's another thing is like when you're looking at flies in a shop, when you're looking at gallop flies, they're meant to be moved, the majority of them.
And I think the only ones that what I would think that aren't, which is the Zoo Cougars one, that doesn't have a lot of movie shit in it.
Right.
It's a pretty stationary silhouette.
The silhouette doesn't move, but it's not a one-dimensional.
The tail
swimmer,
moves. Right? The woolly sculpins don't really.
But they all do. They do that. Yeah. When
they got tails.
Yeah. 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 When they're moved, like the. Yeah, I mean they're not articulated. You're not getting a joint in there, but. And then the other thing I was going to say was, when I talk about throwing spay rods and cross stream, all that stuff, the vast majority of my eats are in the first three moves. Same thing. That's what when I was working in the shop, I would always tell people about fishing the walk wade section here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got a 9-foot rod. A lot of the time I'm throwing 8 to 12 feet of line out of the end of that, right? Which doesn't give you a lot of retrieve space.
Yeah.
Who cares? You don't need it. It's
they're on it.
They're going to eat it in the first three moves or they aren't. And they're, you know, Chuck actually, when we started really, you know, making fun of the Euronymphers, Chuck came up to me one day and he goes, dude, I couldn't sleep last night. I'm like, what? He goes, I realized when we fish the walkway, we're basically just Euronymphing streamers. You're kind of right.
A lot of truth to that.
When I talk to people that were, you know, really wanted to catch fish but didn't really seem that intent on improving technique, I tell them, don't do anything with your left hand. Throw 8 feet of line.
Yeah.
Keep the rod in your right hand, throw it up, and you get three taps. And you're still in a
cast go right from there.
Yeah, you're in a good enough spot to set if they eat it. You know, you're not all the way behind you. And then you can just roll it and go one more. And, you know, you can completely take the this thing out of it, right?
Yeah, you can dumb it down so all my flies don't mean anything. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
No, that's not what I did. But yeah,
you know, that's something I didn't talk about. I want to get two flies.
Yeah.
As long as we're on that, because there's flies I don't fish upstream and there's flies I do. I want to grab a couple. So as long as you brought that up, because it's carrying on about fly design, right? If you are an upstream angler, and that's in particularly in a river as fast as the Madison, it does not behoove you to buy flies with big swingy tails.
Right.
So because like if you take this flatliner or this bangtail, I mean, the bangtail and the flatliner are the exact same fly. It's just orientation of the hook. The flatliner's hook is down, but if you looked at them from the side, you can't tell the difference, right? It's just this one's hooks down like that. This one's hooks down like that. So, but either of them, if you were going to, and if you've not heard us talk about this before, when we, on rivers that are super fast like this, and you don't have the ability to get out in the middle and fish around, and you're basically shore bound, we fish very short. I mean, a 30-foot cast would be a big one. And we generally retrieve, like Braden was just saying, maybe 6-8 feet, right? And you, if you're good with your jerk and you can keep control, if not, you kind of just throw it out and tap, 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 go, right? And so flies, and that's why I said I want to see a couple flies. Like this double deceiver is a spectacular fly cross current. If you throw it upstream, its ass gets pushed down like this. Slick Willy, way bad. Whoa, so quick, it's bent over, right? And you can't really catch up. Same with the bangtail. Now, you go into flies like a woolly sculpin, one of my favorite flies in history. This is a stack blonde. These flies, there's nothing to get, you can't turn the bucktail so much. This one, the tails could get swung around. Anything that's not articulated, this one's got a pretty stiff, even though this isn't my favorite upstream, but it's impossible to hook up because it runs. It's on a keel hook, right?
Yeah.
And this is a giant profile. This is a perch pattern. But if you just toned it down a little bit, but it doesn't have the ability, even though it's got long tails, they don't go around it like something like a bangtail would or a flatliner. These tails are just so light, they end up like this. So you lose any profile you're hoping. Bucktails are spectacular. Want a renaissance? Go back and just tie. This is, you can do, to this day, this is still one of my top producing flies in history. It's not my, it's a stack blind. It's a Joe Brooks blind tied on a keel hook, right? It's still a blind. And so the blind, the Zoo Cougar and the Woolly Sculpin, you know, got to live on them the rest of my life. They'd probably be, it wouldn't bother me. I think there's more versatility to a Woolly Sculpin than almost any fly alive. But if you're looking at flies for upstream, or if you're having problems, make sure that you go back to kind of traditional. They can still be big. This is obscene. This is not a, but a bucktail that long. A friend of mine stopped in, and God, this guy is so good. And he gave me some of these, but this would be like just your traditional bucktail. This isn't a bucktail. This is a Cary Stevens featherwing. But this size fly, upstream, anything like that, Woolly Sculpins, anything that doesn't allow its wing to get folded over on itself. So stay, that's another, it's another idea when you're looking at flies to buy. I've tried to fish this fly upstream here in the olive and white, and it's virtually impossible. Yep. Matter of fact, we were shooting that video.
Yeah, remember on the rock wall.
It couldn't happen. I mean, if you look at the freaking video, my tail's sideways the whole freaking
time. That's
it looked good when
it.
when we first would initiate it, yeah. And then it would be like, thing's worthless.
Yeah, the stall is, it doesn't
done.
Work.
It's yeah, done. Stall, yeah. It's over. And imagine if the fish came at it and it suddenly bent in half.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I remember you said yoga. It while we were filming up there. You're like, I don't normally like big flapper tails or large articulated flies going upstream. And I went, oh, shit. How long have I been doing that for?
Yeah, well, it's pretty hard.
It works sometimes, but it definitely. Yeah, I agree. If you're going to be a, like the walk wade section here, specifically up higher, if you're fishing streamers, you're fishing upstream because these mm-hmm. fish are going to be in that much water yeah. on the bank and likely nowhere else.
And then remember the show we shot where we did nothing but Montana bucktails.
Yeah, the bucktail and the conehead
Mickey
woolly.
Finn.
Yeah.
We didn't even have that. We had a Mickey
Finn.
No, that
Finn was, you jumped that giant fish on the conehead.
The day
woolly.
We did tandems.
Oh.
All day.
Yeah.
Shot tandems all day.
Yes.
We lit this river up. We did not have a fly bigger than a, we had a, your grandpa calls them Montana bucktails.
Yeah, Montana bucktail. Yeah. Bucktail
coachman. This is a Royal Coachman.
Yeah. Shout out black... Touchdown Tommy Baker, by the way. This is his shirt. You like that?
I wonder if I had that shirt.
Yeah, nice shirt, huh?
It's an old one.
Yeah.
But all our flies were this big, and we toasted that thing. We messed that river up, and we didn't, there was a lot of good fish in that.
Well, the day Brian was out here, he rolled some good fish on that Mickey.
Yeah.
None of them ate it, but they were on it. I mean, they were.
And, you know, that's the day, but. So what I'm getting at is even if you don't want to go giant, like this is a pretty big fly, if that fly was that long, if just look at a number four, Royal Coat, Mickey Finn was our, I think the Mickey was the best for us too. Or no, maybe it was a Royal, I can't remember.
The biggest brown trout I've ever caught on a spay rod was on a Mickey Finn.
Yeah.
Swung in the top of the column. I mean, they
let me, I'll let that dog in, I'll grab one and we can show it. Hold on. I know. Well, how come you're all wet? Is it raining again?
All right, so where we were going was...
Well, I just wanted to show, like, this would be a smaller fly for us in the articulated world, right? So the day we were fishing that we were just talking about, this is a Mickey Finn. Look at the profile on this thing. There is nothing to it. We had that. We had a Royal Coachman. Again, if it's wet, it's this big, right? It's getting pulled. Not much to it compared to this. We had a muddler, which we didn't get anything on a muddler that day. And we had a black-nosed dace, which is just a black body with a feather wing. But compare yourself to this, right? And remind yourself that previous to writing Modern Streamers, this was the fly. This was the size. This is a four. It might have been a little bigger. The overall profile wasn't jack. And so that's, and we just caught the hell out of fish on that. Right? Just so when you're upstream fishing, profile, well, this whole thing was about profile and design and stuff like that. Make sure if you're fishing upstream, And for a little bit, for me, the swing, if you are going to swing, because like I said, I frequently, when I would fish tandems, I would swing doubles, right? And I'd have a small fly in the back, which really wasn't even as long as, about this, a little bit shorter than that, maybe a little longer, with the, maybe that long. And it was just marabou top and bottom, the smoke wagon. And that fly is when I would finish, and I didn't really mention that when we were talking about it, when I was fishing tandems, was that the last week or was that this morning? Yeah, whatever. So when I was swinging these things, I would frequently come across and let the fly swing out. And I got eats on that. Always, always on the dropper. Never on my big fly. And I think that might go back to the fact that the bigger the fly gets, the more inspection you get. The smaller the fly is, it's a little. I've already chased this freaking giant thing that all I realize is not real. No, there's a minnow. Maybe they eat it. I don't know.
I also wonder, something I thought about too, because I generally have more success doing dead swings or steelhead swings on smaller flies. I wonder when the fly's not that big, they don't have to eat it by the head. So they might be more comfortable maybe eating it from the
whole
back.
Thing.
Yeah, yeah, it's not a bite, it's a swallow.
Yeah.
Right?
Frequently find that on true steelhead swings too.
Yeah, smaller.
Like, you know, you take a 3 Aykroyd or you take a, you know, 1 or 2, you know, Lady Caroline, and the profiles all change. One thing on steelhead that what I find is I seldom get to go up if I'm having a hard day. I reduce.
Yes.
I get smaller.
Yep.
You know, I might start big, but just for the idea that I've got a bigger hook, I get more bite, blah, 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 whatever. But, you know, I'll end up with a fly that long. And they eat it, right?
Yep. And I mean, if you look at your forage base, like you said in a couple episodes prior to this, when you look at sculpin, I mean, I always think about it in a pyramid, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like sculpin in a river, that bottom chunk that's 85% of sculpin is going to be that big and smaller, right? Yeah, muddler sized. When you get up to the, you know, the 3-inch, 3.5, 4-inch sculpin, I mean, there might be like 6 in the entire river. You know, there's the bigger that gets, the less there are in terms of the pyramid analogy. But
And there's just there's a lot of sculpin.
Tons.
And the two most prominent sculpin that are in most rivers seldom get over 3.5 inches long.
Right.
So
the biggest one I've ever seen was up at a lake. I had a leech under a bobber, and my bobber started bouncing a little bit, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And then I had about a 4.5, 5-inch sculpin on the end of it.
Nice.
So I did what any rational person would do and chucked it back out
there. Yeah, don't bring it in.
Yeah. I didn't get a big fish. But, yeah, I think I always, you know, when I'm struggling and I'm really wanting to put fish in the boat, I downsize.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's something, you know, and it's really, for all the huck, you know, just out there, we're just ripping giant stuff. Sometimes it's just fun to go with the little, I mean, just, I've always got these with me, in particular that, and a couple of my old school that I first started tying.
Yeah.
Right? And just never without a stack blonde. Ever, period, end of discussion. How many shows have we done where it's just like, put on the blonde, boom, there it is. It's like, why didn't we do that 3 hours ago?
And remember when I got out here, I was trying to experiment with how simple of flies could catch fish, because I was spending, you know, I was not a fast tire nor a good tire, but fast was something I was interested in because I really wanted to fish. And, you know, the longer it takes to tie things after work, the less you can go fish them. So speed was, of interest to me. So I tied up a bunch of bucktails. That was a stack on the top of the hook for a tail, stack in the middle of the hook, on top as well, and then at the front of the hook, one on bottom, one on top.
A comet.
Is that what that is?
Yes.
I thought I made it up.
No. Joe Brooks.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it, to me, it was similar, whatever, it's bucktail, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I had a couple of incredible days on the yellow one where just, oh, all right, the bucktail works.
Proficient at tying this fly, which is white, pink, gray, green, you could eliminate the gray, and you did it that long, that would be, if you were proficient, you could do one in 2.5 to 3 minutes.
Yep.
There's been so many articles written about the tricolor bucktail, and I don't really think it matters what the colors are.
Right.
I mean, I always have white in it, but again, this guy had some great, I wish I could remember his name. I forgot his name. I've got it up there. These are classic. I mean, these are so perfectly tied. But that right there, hey, that's polar bear in the middle of that. Good job. Thank you. And that, you could do worse. I mean, you could fish. I always have my traditionals with me, always. And sometimes I just like them better. I'm getting all, you know, sentimental, feeling good about something, and I'm like, ah, screw it, I'm just going to fish Joe Brooks flies all day.
Yep.
You know, whatever. I've had...
They work too.
What's Trey say? That's my joke on fishing world.
Yeah, your joke.
He still believes this net fly has never caught a fish.
I can guarantee that it has.
Yeah. I put the marabou on it. Doesn't need it. But, matter of fact, I don't even think it makes it better. I don't even know why I did it.
Still fishes, though.
Hmm. But if you lick it, now there's one, if you were trying to build a box, if you forgot the whole marabou thing, if you didn't do it on a keel hook, you can see how little, what's on it? Nothing.
Nothing.
There's no body to this fly.
No.
It's just bucktail.
Yep.
And
it does throw a shockingly fishy profile in the water because of how water interacts with bucktail, right?
Yeah.
The way you tie it in where you have it splayed out a little bit, you're going to develop that taper, and then it thins out. And, you know, bucktail's naturally tapered anyways if you do it right. So go tie that fly. It's fun.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember. There's something else I was going to say.
Trying to figure out what year that was. A long time ago. You don't get to try to figure it out. That's your job. Figure it out.
Yeah, well, I figured out.
Make it up.
It might be a good place to end this podcast.
Well, there is 8 inches of snow to get moved off the yard right now.
Kelly's going to go jump in the plow, and I'm going to go home. So, thanks for watching.
I hope you like that. If you got any questions in particular about design flies, because I love this part, maybe even more than the whole fishing technique part of it, because there's a million ways to skin the cat, but man, love talking about fly design and love, it, you know, doesn't have to be about streamers either. There's a lot of other ways to fish. So
that there are.
Hope you enjoyed it. Hope it helps you out.